Precisely because this is difficult, precisely because strong leadership in the history of the world so rarely goes hand in hand with faithful humility, the King's Torah is to be written as a reminder of the role that he plays and of the complexity of Jewish leadership. Welcome to 10 Minute Mitzvah, Episode 14, Richard II and the Scroll of Kings. I'm Meir Soloveitchik.
Rabbi Soloveitchik's year-long 10-Minute Mitzvah podcast is generously sponsored by Ivan and Susanna Kaufman.
It is a well-known Shakespearean scene. Richard II, returning from war in Ireland to England, is informed that his nephew, Bolingbroke, has landed with an army and seeks to overthrow him. With the end of his own power nigh, Richard erupts in a rage, reflecting the very arrogance that has alienated so many and has brought about his downfall. What follows is an eloquent description of his own understanding of the divine right of kings. Richard says about his nephew, "So when this thief, this traitor Bolingbroke, who all this while hath reveled in the night, whilst we were wandering with the antipodes, shall see us rising in our throne, the east, his treasons will sit blushing in his face, not able to endure the sight of day. Not all the water in the rough, rude sea can wash the balm off from an anointed king. The breath of worldly men cannot depose the deputy elected by the Lord." So he says, not all the water in the rough, rude sea can wash the balm off from an anointed king. And if for a moment we leave Richard's own arrogance and political situation aside, the truth is that at times in the Bible, it is indeed the case that not all the water in the rough, rude sea can wash the balm off from an anointed king. If a king has truly been anointed by a prophet of God, then only God can remove that kingship. Thus, David, amazingly, even while hunted by King Saul, refuses to strike at the monarch and even feels guilt for cutting off a bit of Saul's garment because he has laid his hand on a king anointed by God. And yet Scripture simultaneously insists that precisely because a monarch can be so elevated, therefore, monarchical arrogance is utterly inappropriate. The exalted role of the king brings with it a danger, the haughtiness, the hubris, the conceitedness that might result. And it is for this reason that Scripture prescribes a safeguard, which is also our mitzvah for the day. Deuteronomy 17:18. "And it shall be, when he sitteth upon the throne of his kingdom, that he shall write him a copy of this law in a book out of that which is before the priests, the Levites. And it shall be with him, and he shall read therein all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God, to keep all the words of this law and these statutes to do them, that his heart be not lifted up above his brethren, and that he turn not aside from the commandment, to the right hand or to the left, to the end that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel." The king is commanded by the Torah to write a Sefer Torah, a Torah scroll, which he bears with him always. Now, of course, as you hear this, many of you may be remembering that just yesterday, in our previous episode, we discussed that there is a more general commandment of writing a Torah scroll. This is indeed the case, and Maimonides, in his listing of the commandments, follows the obligation of Torah creation with a special obligation upon the king, for this scroll bears with it requirements that are unique. A Torah written by or for any Jew may be kept in any location that is in consonance with its holiness. But upon assuming the throne, the king must write a Torah that he will take with him everywhere, so that his heart not grow haughty over his brethren, and so that he shall seek to apply the teachings of the Torah to the challenges that will face him in leadership. As I argued in my book Providence and Power, King David teaches us that even as boldness, daring, and vision is essential to effective leadership, the Jewish leader must always remember that the Jewish story is a providential tale. King David in the Psalms describes his own daring in battle, but in the end sees his success as a gift of the grace of God. Or as I put it, David as leader plays three-dimensional chess, but he also sees himself as a pawn held in God's heavenly hand. Precisely because this is difficult, precisely because strong leadership in the history of the world so rarely goes hand in hand with faithful humility, the king's Torah is to be written as a reminder of the role that he plays and of the complexity of Jewish leadership. For if he forgets, if a king embraces arrogance and surrounds himself with sycophants, then disaster will result. In another striking scene in Richard II, one of the most politically profound speeches is given not by a statesman, but by a simple gardener in the royal garden, who compares Richard's failure as a king and his resulting deposing to a garden that was allowed to run wild, telling his apprentice to keep everything trim in the botanical specimens that are under their care. The gardener compares gardening to government and informs his apprentice, quote, "All must be even in our government. You thus employed, I will go root away the noisome weeds which without profit suck the soil's fertility from wholesome flowers." So he says. The apprentice in turn asks why they should be careful in their garden if Richard was not equally careful in his larger garden of state. The apprentice asks, "Why should we in the compass of a pale keep law and form in due proportion, showing as in a model our firm estate, when our sea-walled garden, the whole land, is full of weeds, her fairest flowers choked up, her fruit trees all upturned, her hedges ruined, her knots disordered, and her wholesome herbs swarming with caterpillars?" In other words, why should this tiny garden be kept neat if the garden that is England is a mess? The gardener responds that Richard's fall, the fracturing of English society, is Richard's own fault, because Richard as a statesman was not a good gardener. The apprentice is told, "Hold thy peace. He that hath suffered this disordered spring hath now himself met with the fall of leaf, the weeds which his broad-spreading leaves did shelter, that seemed in eating him to hold him up, are plucked up root and all by Bolingbroke." Here Shakespeare is giving us gardening as an image of statecraft. Interestingly, in the play, Richard's own courtiers that surround him have botanical names: Bushy, Green, Wiltshire. And the problem, as the gardener ruefully reflects, is that Richard gave those who surrounded him what they wanted without ordering them properly, without uprooting the unworthy from his court, so long as they sycophantically served him. This is the danger in kingship. And this is why, even if a king, when he was but a prince, already had a Torah scroll, he must write a new one at the moment he ascends the throne and bear it with him always. If he wishes, as Deuteronomy puts it, that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel. As Richard realizes that Bolingbroke will overthrow him, he engages in self-pity and famously says, "Cover your heads and mock not flesh and blood with solemn reverence. Throw away respect, tradition, form, and ceremonious duty, for you have but mistook me all this while. I live with bread like you, feel want, taste grief, need friends, subjected thus. How can you say to me, I am a king?" Richard here is engaging in a pun. He is saying, on the one hand, I am like other human beings. I feel grief. I need friends. But subjected thus, how can you say I am a king? If I feel this way, if I think human thoughts and feel human feelings, how can I be a ruler rather than a subject? Ought not a ruler be above all of these human concerns? This, of course, is incorrect. For a king, even a king chosen by the divine, remains human and must always remember that he, as a human being, rules by the grace of God. I loved reading how, in 1966, when Shai Agnon became the first Israeli Nobel laureate, he was asked by the reporters that came to his home in Jerusalem what most excited him about the prospect of receiving the Nobel Prize from the King of Sweden. And Agnon, as I recall reading in the reporting papers, replied something to the effect of, he was very excited because there is a blessing in the Talmud that is to be said when one sees a king, and he, Agnon, had always wanted to say that blessing. That blessing said over a king is, "Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, asher natan mekvodo lebasar vadam, who gives of his honor to flesh and blood." A king is mere flesh and blood, obligated by the Torah to rule righteously and with wisdom. And only when the king realizes this with humility is he truly royal. This is Mayor Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.